Hi, it's Helen Hebert with Paper Talk. It is June 22nd, I think. Maybe it's the 23rd. 22nd, 2017. And I'm in Portland, Oregon, and I have met up with an old dear paper friend, Jenny Pinto, who 17 or 18 years ago posted a note on the Book Arts listserv. And the subject line was papermaking with plants and lighting. And so I immediately opened that and was curious. And that led to Jenny coming to Portland for a month and working with me. She's from India, so she came over from India, and we worked together and experimented. And we'll talk about that and what she's done since. So hi, Jenny.
Hi, Helen. It's just so nice to be back in Portland after 17 years. And doing Paper Talk with just two of us walking around Portland for a day.
Yeah, it was really wonderful. And you came, you know, only a year after I had moved to Portland. So I have had lots of these interesting memories based on sort of when we were together here. A lot's transpired in between.
Yes.
So, so tell me what initially sparked your interest in paper.
That's always a very tricky question for me to answer, because there was no, you know, how some people just grow up in love, you know, interested in one material, or, you know, or they collect,
right.
You know, there was no relationship with paper like that for me. It was actually a really accidental discovery, and it was a love at first sight when I discovered it. So it's, and I've thought about this often actually, what drew me to paper and how come I wasn't interested in handmade paper before that. It's probably, one of the answers that I've come up with is probably that what interested me about, what interested me most when I started working with paper was probably the number of things you could do with it. I mean, the more artistic side of it, whereas in India, we were not, it's not a material that people work with a lot or think a lot about. In fact, our art colleges don't even teach papermaking. And we have some pretty old art colleges. And the fact is that it is an ancient craft in India.
In India, yeah.
If you date the Chinese papermaking to about 650 years ago, India probably comes close to that, because there was so much trade and exchange with China.
You know, right.
Other crafts were exchanged, like pottery and, textile.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of exchange, and therefore I think India started making paper pretty soon after China discovered paper. And all our old manuscripts, and we have a very old tradition in northeast India, in Rajasthan.
Mm-hmm.
Where, they made paper from jute.
Right. And they were making, using a deckel box technique? Or do you...
No, the deckel and mold.
A mold and deckel.
But it was, it was a removable mold. It was also very much similar, it's very similar to the Japanese technique. They had a mat.
Right.
It was a grass mat, not a bamboo mat, but a grass mat.
Mm-hmm.
And the paper makers were called kagzis, and they had their vats were actually a pit in the ground, and they used river water, and they used...
And they would kneel, or...
Yes,
they would.
So it was... So we have an old tradition, but I think as it came into contemporary times, it just remained... It was revived by Mahatma Gandhi when he revived the whole handmade movement.
Okay.
And he set up, and then after independence, it was probably lost for us for some time, the art and the craft. And then it was revived with the whole revival of the handmade movement by Mahatma Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
And so it remained a kind of village craft. I mean, there is a whole government-sponsored institution called Khadi Village Industries.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, so it's part of that. And so there are a lot of paper factories in North and South India, actually, more in the North, handmade paper factories, but they're factories, they're little cottage industries, and they, and I think something called the Autovat. Nobody lifts paper anymore. There are probably a handful of Kagzis, actually traditional Kagzi families. It was a skill that was passed down like all other crafts
in the family.
In many countries, uh-huh. Yeah, in the family. So there are some Kagzi families, but probably there's like two or three Kagzi families still left to do it totally in the traditional way.
So explain the Autovat a little.
So the Autovat is, it's a vat that has a deckel and mold that has actually just the mold and deckel, which is on a kind of a hinge,
mm-hmm.
and it's lowered and raised out of the water with a pedal, like a lever, you
mm-hmm.
know, which is operated by foot. And so you're not dipping right. the deckel and mold into a vat of pulp, but you're dipping it into water. You immerse it in water, and then you pour the required amount of pulp once
okay.
it's immersed,
mm-hmm.
and then you lift it up, and it's also built so that you can mildly shake it, you know,
uh-huh.
so that it agitates a bit, and then
drains.
You get your sheet, and so you're mm-hmm. you're pouring in exactly the amount of pulp you want, depending on the thickness
uh-huh.
of the
right.
So that's how it's done in practically all handmade paper facilities in India. Which, when I say factory, I don't mean it's huge. They are relatively big. So when I got interested in paper, I researched everyone in India, and there was nobody doing anything artistic or anything at the studio level. We have a lot of studio potters, for instance, but there were no studio paper makers. Which is why I stumbled onto. It was still the early days of the internet in India.
Mm-hmm.
in the late 90s,
right,
and I found this
book arts list,
the book arts list, so
yeah.
Yes, does it still exist?
Yes,
you
it
are
does
it? That's nice. Yes, and then I found that fascinating, that there were so many, that firstly I discovered then that there's something called the book arts,
right,
you know,
right,
and that it covered so many different artistic areas, like, you know, bookbinding, and I mean all these things were really something that's quite removed from art in India.
Uh-huh. And so just to back up,
making.
You already had a career.
Yes.
What age you
yes.
were sort of
yes.
what
yes.
So this was the late 90s.
This was the mid 90s. Yeah, it was a stage, yes, I guess. Sometimes it's all serendipitous.
Mm-hmm.
Everything came together. You know, my daughter was... I was quite a successful TV commercial
mm-hmm.
producer and
mm-hmm.
director and producer in Bombay.
Mm-hmm.
That's the center of it, actually.
Okay.
That's where I grew up. And it was a really good business. I mean, it was... I had absolutely no reason to look at anything else, because I was doing really well.
Right.
And, but the change in my life was that I became a mother.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you think about how much, and making TV commercials, but being a producer is a really busy life. You know,
right.
You get very little time. I mean,
yes.
It's erratic. It's, you know, sometimes you're working really long hours, and I think I stopped to think about it. Do I want to give more time to being a mother?
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I decided that that's what I wanted. So I was looking for something that gave me a quieter life. But I realized that that was not going to happen in Bombay.
Mm-hmm.
Because Bombay is really a city that's, you know, on the go all the time. And I was already like a very established person
mm-hmm.
in my career, and so I felt I had to take myself away. And it's also, and space is a problem in Bombay. It's like being in New York. So if you want
right.
to do, if you want to do anything that requires space, then you're not going to find it in Bombay, unless
mm-hmm.
you're really, really rich,
right.
you know,
right.
or you're willing to move out of the city, or, you know, which, well, I decided, yes, I'd move out of the city. And it also coincided with the time when my daughter came to a school going age, and there were really nice schools in Bangalore. That's why I looked at Bangalore.
Okay.
Bangalore also was a smaller city at that time, and it was easy to find space not too far from home that required for a studio. Mm-hmm. And it was at a time of my life where I was not, I didn't have any economic pressure to, that I had to work all the time. And mm-hmm. so I could afford that putting transition. Back and that transition right. and the time that it took to transit. So right. so we moved. I was lucky that I had a supportive partner and we, mm-hmm. three of us moved to Bangalore. And then I rented a space that when I moved to Bangalore, actually I didn't know it was paper yet.
Okay.
You know, uh-huh. I thought it, in fact it was going to be pottery. Mm. Because that's a craft that always fascinated me. I was just like, it used to be a dream that I, you know, I could. So I actually bought a wheel and I registered for classes in another city in Pondicherry, which was the south of India.
Mm-hmm.
But that had a long waiting list and I had to wait for 2 years to get onto. Because he took only six students at a time.
Right.
A very famous American potter actually called Ray Meeker.
Okay.
And I always give him credit for bringing me to paper indirectly.
By making me wait.
And in the wait, I met an Indian girl who used to do paper as a hobby.
Uh-huh.
And she just did a coffee morning somewhere. And because I was new to the city, and so everything that used to pop up, I'd go because I had the time. I wasn't right. working that much right. anymore. You know, I still used to go back to Bombay to make. It took a little time to sure. wind down the business sure. in Bombay. I took a few assignments and, you know, with the help of my mother and
mm-hmm.
who came to look after my daughter. Mm-hmm. And it was nice that Dia got admission in the school I wanted,
yeah.
which was an alternate school, which was really nice. And so I met this girl called Suhag, who had actually learned papermaking in California.
Uh-huh.
It was a hobby for her, but then she... And even then, it was not that it was immediate, but somewhere down the line, I asked her to come and teach papermaking in Dia's school because they had a very large art facility.
Yeah.
And... I said, I'll help you set it up. So why don't you, you know, and I started helping her set up, and I started really, you know, I realized that this was not just a craft. There was an art, there was a side to it, because I started reading up on it and looking at things that Suhag had, you know, magazines mm-hmm. and looking
right.
at some of her work and it started really growing on me. And I had a wheel, which I had then I used to do. But I sort of set that aside because this started interesting me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then as it happened, which was really something that was fortunate for me, was that Suhag had to come away to the US for 6 months.
Uh-huh.
And she had already started giving classes to the student school, papermaking classes. So she said, do you think you can take over my class for, you know, twice a week
uh-huh.
until I come back? And I said, yeah, sure, because I was going to the art center every day anyway to do,
right.
you know, I had my wheel there. And as I started teaching rudimentary papermaking, just literally lifting, and, you know, we were recycling the paper in school from
yeah.
school, the school
right.
paper was being recycled. It just took over. It just took over my mm. entire week. I just, you know, I realized what I could do with it, and that's when I got onto the net, mm. and I realized that there's nobody else I could really communicate with in India because nobody was doing paper
mm-hmm.
Artistically. And that's when I found the listserv, that's when I found you, and as you say, you opened the email accidentally.
Yeah.
So I think my papermaking journey was a series of accidents, actually, mm-hmm. you know.
I think that's common, it's common, actually,
yeah. Serendipity, as they say.
Yeah.
And I think the turning point was when you said yes.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, oh. And like I said, I sort of look at you as a mentor, because... To find somebody who was interested in exactly what I was interested in,
which was
plants
amazing.
And, you know, papermaking from plants and lights.
Right.
And I guess my background in film gave me some, you know, that's what interested me in light, in the interplay of light. And I used to do amateur photography, and light always interested me.
Uh-huh.
You know, whether it's architecture or even textile to a certain extent. I mean,
right.
if you use light as one.
Yeah.
In fact, even today when people ask me, what are the things that influence you? I always say light as just as a tool of design. I feel
mm-hmm.
that's really important because, like, for instance, what real in architecture, architecture also is something that I look at a lot for structures. And
right.
Say the architecture of Tadao Ando, the Japanese, I hope I pronounced the name right, but the one who did the Church of Light,
mm-hmm.
probably.
Yeah.
And he also works with exposed concrete, so that's probably where that interest came.
Uh-huh.
So it light is a very, very important, I think it's an important tool in designing anything. You know,
yeah.
Even if it's,
yeah.
Whether it's textile or architecture or anything, any mm-hmm. art, any craft, any art. So the fact that I actually found someone like you was, I mean, I don't think I needed an invitation twice. I mean, you didn't need to tell me twice. When you said yes, I was like, yes, I'm going, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so you came for about a month, and you were actually helpful to me. I was working on my book, Paper Illuminated, so I thought that was a perfect... It's yeah. serendipitous, as yeah. you say, and you helped me make the projects for the photo shoot.
Yeah.
So we worked together on that and a few other things. And then you brought over... So I don't know where you just heard about banana fiber, abaca... But you brought banana fiber over, and I was working with abaca, so we did experiments
yeah,
with your
no,
fiber.
Yeah, banana fiber, I heard about it. I mean, it was through actually the reading up on the net, and mm-hmm. through the listserv, I realized that abaca is so close to banana fiber.
Right.
And banana fiber is a material that's used for making yarn that is used in weaving baskets and ropes and stuff.
In India, yeah.
Only in one state in India. So it was a really marginal activity because it's difficult to extract it.
Right.
It's a very time-consuming. And from each banana plant, you get literally a kilo of fiber. That's it.
Right, from a whole
because there's so much
stop.
Air and water in, right. in that trunk.
And so this, only the central part
only
is
the part, yes.
is
yes.
The,
yeah.
the best fiber,
yes.
right?
But I managed to find somebody and I managed to get fiber, which is why I brought some over for you to...
Mm-hmm.
So... We were saying yesterday that you were not sure you had the beater. You had it because we beat it.
I had the beater. We had a miscommunication about VAT and beater.
Ah, yes, yes, of course.
Yeah.
You had the beater. The Hollander, yes.
Yeah.
And getting fiber remained a struggle even till today because what gives much better paper is actually hand-extracted fiber. And now practically
uh-huh.
everybody has moved to machine extraction.
Uh-huh.
And they have rudimentary machines that still leave a lot of pith.
Right.
So we've got to put a little bit more...
Uh-huh.
I use washing soda, and I think that's something also I learned from you, that caustic soda gets really is too strong.
Right.
And doesn't give the translucency that I want. And we never know, we've got so many different kinds of banana in India that I never know which plant I'm getting, you know,
uh-huh.
exactly which. And some give better paper than others.
Right.
But it's the luck of the draw, it's just random.
Mm-hmm. So how do you order it? The banana fiber. Where do you source it from?
From
is it one person that they get it from other places?
Yes,
or
there's a place that sort of aggregates it.
Okay.
From various
right.
From various villages, and it is still a very, very, very marginal economic activity, but they do it
mm-hmm.
to support this craft industry that happens in Kerala and Tamil Nadu.
Right.
Which are two southern states in India.
And so you're getting like a bale?
Yes.
A
I
bale
order it by
of
like about
the...
100, 200 kilos, yes, at a time.
And the fiber looks sort of stringy.
It's stringy and
mm-hmm.
it's long. It's about...
it's not like the abaca we have that's pre-processed is
no,
what I'm getting at.
No,
it's
yes.
that...
No, no, it's not. Yes, it's totally raw. It comes
right.
straight from... and it's about 5 feet long. Again, it's random. It depends on the size of
right.
the plant.
And
so
how do you cut it? Do you have a machine?
So, no, we have a very rudimentary machine that is used again in the craft industry,
uh-huh.
you know, in rope making.
Right.
So we cut it. It's sort of manual, but it's a very extremely low-tech machine
mm-hmm.
that's used to cut. It's literally like a cutter.
Like a paper cutter.
Like a paper cutter.
Uh-huh.
So they cut it. So which means that in my case, it's a labor-intensive process. And it's not... So... Being a studio papermaker, I mean, my studio has a lot of people working there. It's not like, you know, studio papermakers here who are, or studio artists here who, are,
right.
who work singly and do everything. But because that's because you get things pre-processed and
mm-hmm.
you can go to an art supply store. We don't have... Our art supply stores supply just for, literally for painters
mm-hmm.
and maybe a few sculpting tools, nothing more than that. So my trip... to you was also useful because I could pick up so many tools, you know.
Right, right.
And I did. And it was nice doing the workshop. I mean, it was great working with you on your, for the projects for the book and being able to work in your studio.
Mm-hmm.
But what was also nice was that I got a chance to do some workshops with you.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went across to the East Coast and did a few bookbinding workshops.
Right.
Which were also really nice, which I did for a little while back in India. But it was lamp making that really was my... I just fell in love with it, actually.
Right. And so you... So after that trip, you went back and you built a studio. And you're a businesswoman. I mean, it's really impressive everything you've done.
I guess it was it. The what made a difference is that I came to this in my mid career. It was not something that I was. I was not 22. You know, then you're struggling with everything.
Yeah.
But here it was the middle of my career. I had a little bit of. I'd already made a little bit of money, so mm-hmm. There was no struggle in terms of buying equipment, and I had, mm-hmm. because there was no pressure to make money, I had that time to go and explore, because I had to convince people to make me a small beater. Nobody had made such a small Hollander in their lives. They were making Hollander beaters for these facilities in India, right. Paper making facilities. But the large ones, I mean, to process, the minimum they were processing was about 20 kilos.
Right.
And I wanted something that processed 2 kilos, which mm-hmm. is a model I picked up in America. I mean, all of you had 2 kilos.
Right, 2 pounds. Mm-hmm.
So to convince them, and then they would come up with a random price, and I'd have to say, at some point, they had the upper hand, because right. I had to agree to whatever they said. You know, you could bargain a little bit, and then a press, again... You know, I had to convince them to fabricate a small one for me.
That's another thing that's interesting in that you're able to. I mean, we can have things fabricated, but when it comes down to like multiple lamps and parts for lamps, and we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but things like that, you can just you can find people to make them.
To fabricate, yes. That's because India is...
Whereas here we might have to order 1,000 of them from a big company. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really different in India because of labor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think now politically America's actually dealing with that.
Yes,
you know, that things get outsourced to a country that has cheaper labor. So that's the advantage we have.
Yeah.
But the disadvantages are that we... need to do things from scratch. We don't find mm-hmm. the tools that you need. You've got to fabricate them.
Right.
You know,
right.
Even some of the tools you need to. But we have skilled carpenters. I was able to get deckle and mold the sizes mm-hmm. I wanted. Mm-hmm. I made a vat. And of course, I was so fascinated with everything Japanese and paper making. So I wanted a wooden vat. So I made a really expensive. That was a luxury.
Yeah.
But then eventually I got a fiberglass vat made because the wooden vat was... And then water is a problem in India.
Uh-huh.
And I found a really nice piece of land which was actually not... We didn't get government... although it's just on the outskirts of Bangalore, we didn't get government water. I had to borrow well.
Uh-huh.
And then just as things are going now in India, development just happens in unplanned ways. That whole area around my studio where I was practically one of the only buildings there, and it was a mud road to get there. But although mm-hmm. it was only... 13 kilometers from where I lived.
Uh-huh.
Today, it has developed so much into a suburb that there's water problems, and we are still not getting water from the government. We have to buy water. So that is something that's actually, you know, the downside. But then I found an architect who really sort of got exactly what I wanted, because I said if I'm doing paper, which is a green... is such an eco-friendly craft, then my studio must be also green.
Right.
And I found this architect, who became a really good friend, and she's still a good friend, who she worked with alternate architecture, which was mud block architecture, which was just becoming quite popular in India, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an old way of, an ancient way of building.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, what you call adobe.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But adobe is slightly different. Here you make the bricks on the site from the mud that you get from your foundation.
Okay.
But anyway, to cut a long story short, I built a green building. But what was green about the whole thing was that we also recycled all the water that came out of the paper making, as well as the grey water. Mm. And we harvested rain from the roof.
Uh-huh.
So the water goes back into, not all, it doesn't go back into paper making. I use it in the garden actually.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time I grew an organic vegetable garden because I had a little extra space.
Right.
But the building was designed in such a way that we don't need to turn on the lights at all during the day.
Mm.
And we don't need fans in a warm country. So it was, yeah. She really designed it well in terms of airflow and light and, you know, so and the architecture, I mean, the building itself drew a lot of interest. I mean, a lot of architecture magazines interviewed me about it, took pictures, and then there was an architect who actually now teaches in Harvard, who brought out a book on architecture in India after the 70s, and he featured the book. The studio was featured in that book because of its interesting architecture. So it's a nice building, and it feels really good to work in it, actually.
Yeah. Okay, so we're talking a lot. Let's move on to the lights and the work.
Yeah, sorry, I get carried away, I know.
That's okay.
So the lighting was, it was really a lovely journey, actually. And my designs really come from playing with paper. Mm-hmm. So I don't sit down and design a light, or even if I design something, it's more, I let the paper take over at some point. I mean, my influences are always, and I think definitely working with you influenced also the fact that we played around with paper a lot, and you did too.
Yeah,
you
very interested in the material and the potential material itself, of it. Yes.
So I spent at least 2 years or more, because I was already making paper for about 2 years when we spoke. And I'd spent a lot of time just experimenting just to see how the material behaved. And then this thing of the technique of overbeating, I, of course, learned it practically with you. I had read about it, but you have to see someone do it and, you know, exactly, to know exactly when to lift the roller and how long and the cooking. And unfortunately, I had this fabulous material. I mean, as a raw material, banana fiber is as good as flax. And just gives you, an overbeating gives you fabulous results.
Right.
So, you know, the technique of sandwiching and the wire, everything just worked so beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a lot of time just seeing how the paper behaved.
Mm-hmm.
And from the shapes and things that I got, and of course, as you do it more, you're able to control things. You know, and once you understand the material, my designs really came out of what the paper did. I let the paper lead me in most cases, and of course, it always helped that I was like I said. I mean, just with setting up, it helped in setting up. It also helped here, where I was not in a hurry to sell. It didn't really matter,
right?
And actually, as a material, like I said, nobody really knew paper in India. So. But again, my timing was right because India was beginning to, you know, I mean, there was, like I said, like we were talking, speaking the other day, economically, India opened up, India opened up its economy to the world in the 90s. It became a global economy. And so people were more prosperous, you know, there was a lot more money that the middle class could spend. And that's when you start looking at building, you know, spending money on your homes and doing up the interiors.
Yeah.
That was a booming business, actually, building and interior design. So my timing was right. I had a lot of, and that's when people started looking at newer materials. And so I had a lot of interest from architects.
Mm-hmm.
And, but yet I was not in a hurry. So I was able to, like, say, okay, fine, this is what I can do, you know, and this is what I do. And if you like it, you buy it. I mean, if you don't, you don't. It's okay. If you don't trust, because then a lot of people, like what you said, you get the same questions here. How do you dust it? How do you keep it clean? How long does it last?
Is it going to burn?
And, but I must say, a lot of those things, those questions were answered by American designers and artists because people were doing it. You know?
Right.
For me, it was something new, but and nobody else was doing it in India, but there were so many here doing it. That really helped because I got a lot of questions answered, a lot of techniques that you, I could get. And the internet was such a, I can't imagine doing it in the 70s, for instance. I'd be lost, you know.
Right.
I'd be totally alone and lost and not knowing where to go. So it helped. And so it grew. And another thing is because the client base was growing, your designs last longer in the market because, you know, you get new people looking at something that you did 3 years ago. And that's actually still happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's the market for paper, lights is still growing.
Right.
So some of the designs that I did in early 2000s, like, in, you know, after I came back from America, they're still selling.
Right.
Because the person is new.
Yeah.
You know, the client is new.
Right.
So, but it was, it's been an interesting journey. I mean, then I have a, as you can see on the website, I have a range that's totally organic in shape.
Mm-hmm.
And I still, that's, those are my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have some things that are, that you can do in multiples, you know, so the very straight shapes that are just, you know, sconces or wall sconces or the straight shapes, so which I call the influenced by cities. So they are sometimes influenced by buildings or, you know.
Right, and so the people, now you have kind of a showroom, or how do people...
Earlier, the people would come to the studio, to the and then, studio. Of course, there were stores in various cities that took the lights.
Okay.
And so, it and then I... Trade shows became... I mean, I did a couple of trade... A couple of exhibitions, which mm-hmm. I... But I didn't do... I stopped doing that because... It's inexpensive. Paper is an expensive thing to transport. You've got to pack it, you know.
Right.
It's so easy when you're a fashion designer. You can put it all into a box and take it there and then iron it out. But papers, you've got to be careful. And then the unsold stuff, you've got to be as careful bringing it back. So I stopped doing exhibitions. But what helped was that, what also helped a lot was the press. Because it generated a lot of interest in the press. So I had, till today, I get a call from at least one magazine a month.
Wow.
You know,
uh-huh.
that wants to feature the work because it's still a new material.
Right, sure.
After all these years, there's nobody who's... I don't have too much of competition.
Mm-hmm.
My competition is actually foreign designers.
Huh.
Even Noguchi Lamps or Maurer.
Right,
you know,
right.
And that for people who can afford their prices.
My
lamps cannot be priced anywhere close to theirs.
Uh-huh.
But they're expensive for India because people still ask those questions, how long will it last? And,
right.
So what helped was the publicity. So now, I'm happily now at a stage where I don't need to go out to clients too much.
Right, so, they come to you, yeah.
But in the past, 3 years ago, I had someone who was interested to buy my business.
Mm-hmm.
So right now he does the... We do one of the... We go to a kind of a interior design trade show once a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that brings in a lot of new clients.
Right. So you sold the business.
I sold the business.
And you're working...
As you said, it became a business. I mean, that was not where it intended to go, but that's where it went.
Yeah, right. And you're working for 5 years.
I have a commitment I have a commitment to be, so I'm still creatively involved.
Right.
I have
designing my products.
Design,
mm-hmm.
And then last year, we've been discussing, I still have to show you the designs,
uh-huh.
but of course there's this constant pressure to come up with something new. There is, a designer can't ever, it's not even because of the market, it's because of yourself. You need to, you keep looking at things, getting inspired.
Right.
And I'm just a curious person by nature, so I have to, like I said earlier, architecture is a huge influence on me.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain architects I follow. And exposed cement became a very popular... It is, not became, it still is a very popular style of architecture in India.
Uh-huh.
You know, lots of people got into that, which is actually quite new for India because we're more into a very decorative art and a lot of, most people even today will over-decorate their homes.
Right.
You know, but there is a growing number of people who look at minimalism and which is why, and that's where that's the kind of clients who look at my lights, actually.
Uh-huh.
You know, they understand the... And I must say, paper, actually, the moment you turn on a paper light, I think it beats everything else.
Yeah.
You know? Uh-huh. And there are some clients who just, even today, you know, if I meet them, they'll say, oh my God, it's just so lovely to have paper lights at home. Mm-hmm. And I've actually had clients who I've had to say, look, I think you need to bring in some other material. Don't put paper everywhere. Uh-huh. And that makes me feel good inside. But at the same time, I feel they need to have something else. You can't just... But the fact is that paper just gives... Paper lights are just... I mean, when you have paper lights at home, it just transforms your home, actually.
It does,
transforms the way you experience your own home,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in that... concrete was a material that, again... And I didn't know... No, actually, the funny thing was that when I was building the studio, my architect, Chitra...
Mm-hmm.
She told me about papercrete.
Okay.
And she said, you know, why there's this material and why don't we do some outdoor furniture? Because my studio has got a lot of center courtyard and a lot of and things that lead out of the courtyard, which are workspaces.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, things that are not totally exposed to the rain, why don't we make some benches and seating and all out of papercrete? And I was very excited and I said, yes, let's do it. But for some reason, we didn't do it.
Mm.
So papercrete was at the back of my mind when suddenly I had an intern actually 2 years ago who came from design school, and we were discussing what she could possibly do, and she said, what about concrete? I would like to work on concrete lights.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying, okay, fine, but that's not quite paper. When it suddenly struck me, why don't we try papercrete, you know?
Right.
Because then that'll be something that you can do in the studio, because concrete was not something that would make sense otherwise in the studio. And I was lucky that she was like really dedicated and she was very hardworking and she put in a lot of time researching it.
And so talk a little bit about the actual material then. How do you make the papercrete?
So the papercrete... Anyway, I mean, papercrete is not something that I invented, but papercrete is actually concrete and paper pulp.
Mm-hmm.
And it is used, and actually, it's a lot of American, it's used in America,
mm-hmm,
lots of people do it. But it's used as a building material, and it's used as a low-cost material, and it's used... it's made in a really fascinating way. I mean, I saw there were a lot of videos on YouTube, and this guy has this rudimentary vat he's constructed his own machine, which is actually used the blades of a lawnmower.
Uh-huh.
And in order to work that, he's attached like a trailer to his tractor, and he drives it around. and the movement of the... You know, he has to move his vehicle to run this. It's like,
right.
It's like
a bicycle.
Or maybe like a bicycle, what do you call that? Yeah, so it's not, it doesn't run on electricity. So it's like really low, really green, uh-huh, you know, in that sense. And then you're making this green material. But it's a material that becomes like clay. It's like you mix paper pulp and cement in various and different proportions.
And is it recycled paper?
It's recycled paper.
Okay.
It's recycled paper. And you could, if you want to add an adhesive, you can, or you needn't. You can add even clay, which really finely sieved.
Mm-hmm.
That's really fine clay. You can add clay. That also, you know, brings in a little color. And depending on the color of the clay, we have different... We're trying that in the studio right now, actually.
So you're making cast paper lights.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Papercrete lights.
So
in molds.
And so you're just, like, packing... By hand?
Yes, packing by
the
hand.
The pulp into the
mixing molds. By hand and packing by hand.
And the molds are...
Made of fiberglass.
So there are different shapes.
Yes. And so the things that I did with paper in the 90s when I started making paper, which was doing leaf impressions and stuff,
uh-huh,
we're doing that now with this.
Uh-huh, right.
I'm using the same thing, similar techniques that I used for paper then.
Uh-huh.
You know, embedding and
embossing
and... and then we do a little bit of brass or copper rub on the imprint, so it gives it a bit, you know, somebody. And then I I'm combining it with very similar things that I combine my paper with, which is stone, and so the, you know, the
for the
fixing
bases,
details for the bases,
yeah,
for the fixing,
mm-hmm,
details,
mm-hmm, And
it's not translucent, so they have to be downlighters or uplighters.
Right.
So even if they're table or floor, they have to have a
And how thick is the?
It goes from the shade. It's actually I'm able to get for the smaller lights. We can because it's so the material is quite light and strong.
Mm-hmm.
10 mm, 11 mm.
10 to 11 millimeters.
Yeah, yeah. Millimeters, and then it goes thicker than that.
And how long does it take to dry one?
It takes a day and a half, and then now that we're looking at certain problems we're having as the weather gets drier, I think we now have to start treating it more like concrete, and which means that we've got to cure it.
Right.
By wrapping it in, so it'll probably now, I think when I get back, we're going to be
Figuring that out.
Yeah, it's going to just take, clients are going to have to wait longer.
Right.
Because we were drying it in about two, depending on the weather, because Bangalore weather changes quite a lot, it rains quite often, and then the drying time gets longer.
Right. So I want you to just describe a day in the studio. Like, how many people are there? What are they doing? Briefly.
Now I have about almost 30 people, actually, after we started doing these papercrete lights.
Mm-hmm.
So almost 30 people. Because everything is done from scratch and by the whole process. I mean, most of the people are actually involved in the processing.
Right.
And now since we have two departments, I know it sounds funny, but there's the paper department and there's the papercrete department.
Right, right.
So there's, we're getting people to specialize because it's far more efficient that way. Because earlier, everyone did everything depending on what was needed, what needed to be done. So now I have three people who do only the, and I still lift, I don't have an autovat, I still do it totally the traditional way.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really feel the paper is stronger,
right?
And more, you have more control,
right?
So I have three people who are only paper makers, and they do the, and then I have one person, and then as and when some of the junior staff just float between the two groups,
okay?
And so like the, you know, the junior staff will do the fiber cutting, and whenever they're needed to help, they'll be, you know, they sort of. So there must be two or three boys who are assigned to various tasks who float. But otherwise, everyone's specialized in doing certain. And I have the oldest staff. I have a boy called Prashant and a girl Amu who's been with me for practically the 20 years that I've been doing it. So they're really experienced, and all of them, of course, since there's paper again is like I said, is such a marginal craft as well.
Right.
No, I get no experienced people. There's absolutely no experienced
people. Right. And what about people trained? Has anybody, you say you meant interns come through your studio from design schools, but not too many have gone on to.
A few of them.
To do their own thing.
Few of them have done that. But because it's, for a newcomer, it's expensive to set it up.
Right.
And and most of my designs actually are dependent on processing, doing manipulation when the paper's wet.
Right.
So although some have gone on to make lamps, they have to buy paper.
Right.
So the wet manipulation is something that only, that you know, you can do if you're making the paper yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's my advantage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's
So I wonder when you step back, do you feel like your partner or the person that bought your business will it go on?
Oh yes, it will go on, and I think it's, you know, now, I mean, I don't know whether I can ever step back 100%.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the person, my partner who's bought it, is now also a close friend, so I think I'm always going to be around, and I can't see myself not stepping in when help is needed or when troubleshooting or, you know.
Yeah.
Or I can't. It's, I mean, it's now, I think this is so much my baby.
Right.
It's going to be difficult to just, you know, I think like a mother, you're always around like a mother hen.
Right, right.
Till the grandchildren arrive and then, you know. So, yeah, I still think of every light that comes out of there as my baby. Because it's been, it's not just my creation. I think each lamp is also sometimes my teacher because I really learn with everything that happens in the studio. Mm-hmm. I'm still learning, you know, and it's still, it still actually such a joy when, and I think the most joyful things are the mistakes you make. You suddenly realize, mm-hmm. oh my God, you know, you can, this can also happen, and I can also right. use it in this way. And,
right.
and I did a lot of, I've taken time off from making lights to do a lot of art projects.
Mm-hmm.
And those have really been, like I say, that's like constantly a learning experience
right.
for me. And I look
right.
at things anew, you know, every time some, I mean, and you know, when you work with paper and every time you sandwich a wire, it's going to do something different when it dries.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah.
And sometimes it just reminds you of something that you've seen as your, you've been trekking in some mountain or you've been, you know, some leaf. I still pick up, even till today, I pick up dried leaves when I'm walking. And because,
uh-huh.
you know, it gives you
yeah.
a new shape.
Yeah.
It gives
yep.
you, oh, okay,
they curl.
I can do
yeah.
this the way this
yeah.
curls. Or,
ah.
That's the fascinating
mm-hmm.
thing about, because
mm-hmm.
it's a interaction, it's a give and take, and it's a, you learn
yeah,
with everything you
learning.
Do. So yeah,
yeah,
it's a teaching.
Absolutely.
A teacher and a learner all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, wonderful. Thanks, Jenny.
Thank you, Helen. I have to say again, it's been so wonderful meeting you.
Yeah,
and
likewise.
Again.
And you can see Jenny's work at jennypinto.com, and we'll have a little more information on the website with the clip. Okay, talk to you later.